Some ruthless and unrepresentative regimes even conspired with the U.S. and with the illegal Zionist entity, the sworn enemy of Islam and Muslims, which possesses doomsday atomic arsenal for holding Arab states in perpetual bondage against Iran by falsely parroting the West's baseless accusations of development of nuclear weapons, despite the fact that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued the fatwa prohibiting as haram or religiously illegal the manufacture of any weapons of mass destruction. Nonetheless, Iran, having been blackmailed in 2015 to sign the dubious JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which the U.S. itself breached in 2018, is now extra cautious against Washington's deception, including threats of force and the Israeli regime's dog's hysterical barking, to bow once again to Western pressures for inking any lopsided accord when it has the necessary know-how, the dedicated workforce, and the independent system of government to chart out its peaceful path in the enrichment of uranium as per its requirements for development in various fields without being dependent on other countries for its needs. The Islamic Republic of Iran, brushing aside the plots of its enemies who are banding together in sheer desperation, has kept open its offer to friendly regional states of cooperation in the peaceful use of nuclear energy, and recently took a vital step in this direction by holding important talks with fraternal Iraq. Head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, and his team of experts, during their meeting with a delegation of Iraqi Muslim elites and university professors, discussed the sharing of nuclear technology for progress in a variety of fields, including mulching operations to prevent the frequency of desert sands threatening both the countries. The Iraqi experts, who were highly pleased with the spectacular achievements of Iran in the peaceful nuclear field, expressed the desire to expand cooperation in this vital field in various other sectors such as agriculture, industry, pharmaceuticals, hydrocarbons, etc. The two countries are well aware that the United States, the Zionist regime, and their Arab clients will be angered by these growing ties. But there is nothing that these common enemies of Iran and Iraq can do to prevent cooperation between Tehran and Baghdad. Hopefully, Iran and Iraq will set the precedent in this and other fields that is likely to convince other states of regional cooperation rather than licking the boots of the U.S. and serving the satanic interest of the Zionist entity against Islam and fellow Muslims.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met Heather, Josh, and Rachel. All three suffer from disability and chronic illnesses. All three are children to fathers who fought in Vietnam and all three are victims of Agent Orange. And now they decide to embark on a journey to return to the country where their tragic story began as children of war veterans and as victims of war. Now stay with us to witness the rest of this emotional and healing journey.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive and he was very violent, and he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they would fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and you couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them and landmines everywhere and tripwires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. When you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go and like his friend would be walking right in front of him and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos, books, that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything, and the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general, and when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all them women and children.
Thank you.
And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. There was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with. I got a ride from my dad and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house. And I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know. So I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went and I went to the side with them and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there was some people that were riding some motorcycles and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me, because all my life my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed, and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
Snipers out. When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975 that it's still in infancy. I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything.
I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs, and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath, you know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting, come on, nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited, come on, something, say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something. Nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
These people have taken me in. Like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face, or I just had no idea what to expect. But after after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
I've come and I've been able to put faces. It's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I'd been raised with one side of the story. Now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
The Red Cross estimates that 3 million Vietnamese have been affected by dioxin, including at least 150,000 children born with serious birth defects. Millions of Americans and Vietnamese are still suffering directly and indirectly by the wartime U.S. spraying of Agent Orange and other herbicides over southern and central Vietnam. Question is, how many more generations must suffer, and how long will this deadly legacy of U.S. crimes against innocent lives linger on? Well, that's it, everyone, for this program. Until next time and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Making a mockery of his own campaign vow to treat the repressive Saudi kingdom as a pariah, U.S. President Joe Biden recently greeted Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who intelligence agencies believe approved the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, with a fist bump as he arrived at the royal palace in Jeddah. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading From Bonesaw to Pariah to Fist Bump, Outrage as Biden Greets Madras Saudi Prince. Stay tuned for more. Making a mockery of his own campaign vow to treat the repressive Saudi kingdom as a pariah, U.S. President Joe Biden recently greeted Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who intelligence agencies believe approved the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, with a fist bump as he arrived at the royal palace in Jeddah. Already furious over the president's decision to meet with the crown prince, despite his role in the brutal 2018 murder of Khashoggi and subsequent cover-up attempt, human rights defenders responded with outrage to the greeting, which the Saudi regime swiftly blasted out on social media. The bloody fist bump seen around the world, said Sarah Lee Whitson, executive director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, adding, "You have humiliated our entire country." Hatis Kengiz, the fiancé of Khashoggi, a U.S. resident who wrote for the Washington Post before he was tortured, killed, and dismembered with a bone saw inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, replied on Twitter, "The meeting between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince, commonly known as MBS, is expected to touch on a range of issues, from the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen to oil production in the midst of ongoing conflicts in Eastern Europe." Biden, on Thursday, refused to commit to bringing up Khashoggi's murder during the meeting. In an interview ahead of Biden's visit, she told the Associated Press that Biden is backing down on human rights in the interest of boosting oil production. Just under 3 years ago, during his 2020 presidential campaign, Biden promised to make the Saudi leadership pay the price for the Khashoggi murder and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. She said, "It's a very huge backing down, actually. It's heartbreaking and disappointing. And Biden will lose his moral authority by putting oil and expediency over principles and values." Also, MSNBC's Mehdi Hassan noted in a segment recently that even by Saudi standards, Mohammed bin Salman is truly brutal ruler, the worst of the worst. Whatever we are getting from this meeting may be maybe a slight fall in gas prices. Is it really worth selling out the family of Jamal Khashoggi, the people of Yemen, and our moral authority and values? Hassan asked. One of the failures of President Biden has been completely disengaging the U.S. from the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which he had pledged to do. Although there has been a successful 2-month ceasefire, the war could flare back up at any time. The Biden administration has vowed only to provide the Saudis with defensive weaponry, but there is no firm definition for such things in the U.S. legal code. The Government Accountability Office has recently issued a new report on the role of U.S. provided weaponry in civilian deaths in the Yemeni war, many of them the result of war crimes. in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and their allies launched a war on Yemen in 2015, some quarter of a million people have been killed, most by disease and hunger caused by the war, and half the population has been made food insecure. Of those killed in airstrikes, about 17,000 are known to have been civilian non-combatants, according to the UN. In late January of this year alone, Saudi and UAE fighter jets supplied by the United States hit three primarily civilian sites, including a hospital and a telecommunications corporation. The strikes killed 80 civilians and caused 156 injuries, and that was just one two-week period. Deutsche Welle reported on one of these January airstrikes. The GAO reports the mind-boggling statistic that the United States Department of Defense has administered $54.6 billion in aid to Saudi Arabia and the UAE during the Yemeni war. Somebody should be fired for that right there. First of all, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are fabulously wealthy oil states and do not need any aid from the United States regime. Second of all, the aid was in furtherance of a horrible illegal war in which the U.S. should never have been involved. Any aid that involved the transfer of U.S. weapons to the two countries was actually corporate welfare intended to throw the government money to American arms corporations.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. The next recommendation is that you must make the most of the people's faith for producing good deeds. The people are pious and have faith. This faith can produce good actions. You can do this. Our magnanimous Imam was a master at this. Imam was a genius in making the most of the people's faith for producing good deeds. The next recommendation is that you should not let some people pretend that the country has reached a dead end. This is some people's job right now in cyberspace. Now some individuals do it out of negligence or they are paid to do it. I do not know, but they want to pretend that the country has reached a dead end. No, the country will not reach a dead end. This happened at the time of Imam too. At that time, some people wrote in newspapers that the country had reached a dead end. Imam said, no, it is you who reached the dead end. The Islamic Republic will not reach a dead end. He said that it was they who had reached a dead end. This is the truth of the matter. You should not let them disappoint the people.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next recommendation is that Imam would sometimes criticize executive officials in private or in public, but he would also sometimes express his appreciation for their efforts. There are many cases in which Imam explicitly thanked the officials of the country, either one official or a group of them. My recommendation is that now that the enemy is after damaging the reputation of revolutionary officials, the duty to appreciate the value of officials is a heavy one. We must express our appreciation of officials. When we see that in the Abadan incident, a minister goes there for 3-4 days and inspects the matter from close up, is very important. That the honorable president or vice president goes and meets with casualties and comforts them and consoles their hearts is very valuable. They must be thanked. Of course, the agents behind the damage inflicted must be punished, both in Abadan incident and every other incident. Those who inflict damage must surely be punished. Dear God, by the blessed souls of our dear martyrs and the immaculate soul of our Imam, make us among the followers of the legitimate and true path of the Islamic Republic. Dear God, I ask you to make our steps and those of our nation steady on this path. I was informed that today, during the speech of Haji Hassan Khomeini, some people made noise. I'm opposed to this. I'm not at all right with such acts of damaging someone's reputation with such commotion. I'm opposed to it. Let everyone know this. I hope the God Exalted guides all of us toward the right path, God willing. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Today I have perfected for you your religion and completed my favor on you and chosen for you Islam as a religion.
Eid Qadir celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of the Holy Prophet, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. Here at IRIB English Radio, congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious and joyous occasion of Eid Qadir. A happy Eid Qadir to all our listeners. in the limelight.
Internal documents reveal how Uber company won access to world leaders, cozied up to oligarchs and dodged taxes amid chaotic global expansion. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Common Dreams staff. This article is published under the heading, The Uber Files, 124,000 leaked files expose global dirty dealings of ride-hailing giant. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Over 124,000 internal corporate files and documents, including private communications between top executives, are the basis of new reporting published recently dubbed The Uber Files, a detailed look at the ride-hailing juggernaut that aggressively lobbied governments around the world to ease regulations and pass legislation friendly to the company's bottom line, but often harmful to traditional taxi rivals and its own drivers. First obtained by the Guardian newspaper in the UK and subsequently shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, the trove of documents offers a damning picture of the US-based tech company that revolutionized ride-hailing with a smartphone app that allowed independent drivers to become instant taxi cab drivers. According to the ICIJ, as it grew from a scrappy Silicon Valley startup to a world-conquering multi-billion dollar operation, Uber promoted itself as a leader of the digital revolution. But the tech company pushed its agenda the old-fashioned way. Uber's scandals and missteps in the United States, from its spying on government officials to its leaks of executive misconduct, have been the subject of books, TV series, and newspaper investigations. Now, a new leak of records revealed the inside story of how the ride-hailing giant's executives muscled into new markets, then managed the fallout, spending gobs of cash on a global influence machine deployed to win favors from politicians, regulators, and other leaders who were often eager to lend a hand. The Guardian reports how the extensive leak of data lays bare the ethically questionable practices that fueled the company's transformation into one of Silicon Valley's most famous exports. The newspaper says the files cover the five-year period when Uber was run by its co-founder, Travis Kalanick, who tried to force the cab-hailing service into cities around the world, even if that meant breaching laws and taxi regulations. Episodes detailed in the reporting include ruthless behavior of Kalanick, who appeared less concerned with the well-being of Uber drivers than securing the company's ability to operate in new cities or countries. Gig Workers Rising, a collective of workers operating in the gig economy, said the leak shows how ruthless Uber was with Kalanick at the helm, but that the company continues to mistreat its drivers. Responding to the first batch of reporting on the files, with much more expected in the coming days, Sandeep Vasan, legal director of the Open Markets Institute, a think tank focused on corporate power and monopolies, called it a damning report on Uber's predatory methods of competition and growth, which antitrust enforces here and abroad unfortunately aided and abetted because innovation, unquote.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Every year in the lunar month of Dhul Hijjah, Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, a major festivity on the Islamic calendar, marking the day when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor, and Muslims' next leader some 14 centuries ago. In Iran's city of Mashhad, the shrine of Imam Reza has been hosting pilgrims who have come days ahead of the auspicious occasion to celebrate the festivity.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all fellow Muslims. I come from Iraq to participate in the celebrations here in Mashhad.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the day when Prophet Muhammad announced to Muslims that Imam Ali is the next Muslim leader. He raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever I am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Eid al-Ghadir comes 8 days after another major festivity on the Islamic lunar calendar, dubbed Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
To us Iranians, it's a blessing to visit the shrine of Imam Reza on the Feast of Sacrifice and other festivities. Those of us who can't make it to Mecca on the Hajj usually come to Imam Reza's shrine to pray and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere.
Imam Reza is the eighth Shia imam, whose bloodline goes back to the Prophet of Islam. He holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran, away from his birthplace in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Every year, his holy shrine hosts millions of pilgrims from around the Muslim world, especially during religious occasions. Iranians never miss a chance to come and visit the shrine of Imam Reza. And now that Eid al-Ghadir is just around the corner, Shia Muslims find it an opportunity to once again attend this holy site and share the festive mood with each other. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Veretz, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Olaz Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotavets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism.
They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. They basically, that's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. So, like the old saying is that the other one's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter. And hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The EU's tourism industry is currently thriving, but make no mistake, businesses facing huge overheads are struggling to turn a profit. In its summer economic forecast, the European Commission has revised growth downwards and inflation upwards. The bloc is concerned Russia is going to turn off all its gas supplies.
This risk has become more than just a hypothetical scenario for which we need to prepare. So a storm is possible.
For millions, the storm is already here. Governments are accused of not providing support to deal with the cost of living crisis arising from sanctions against Russia, but can find money for other causes. The EU is providing 9 billion euro to Ukraine to run the country and has sent a separate 2 billion for military equipment. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. Citizens say fueling the Ukraine war is costing the EU too much.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Yes, of course we need to end the war, but the problem is nobody knows how to end the war, you know.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has been facing pressure during a visit to the European Parliament.
NATO, along with the US and the EU, were never a defensive mechanism, not before the war and not after it. They are offensive. Ukraine has been sacrificed for their interests.
Experts warn the growing social crisis in the EU will have dire consequences for the political establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians. The United States' adoption of Zionist plans is based on uprooting our people from their land by force and obliterating their identity and history in favor of the Zionist entity.
During his trip to the occupied territories, Joe Biden visited U.S.-funded missile interception systems, including the so-called Iron Dome and Iron Beam. The Islamic Jihad movement says the U.S. administration only aims to prolong the Israeli occupation and support its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Biden's visit comes to serve the interests of the Zionist entity, and he's not welcomed in our land. We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime share the same interests. Joe Biden has ignored the suffering of the Palestinian people and continues to support the Zionist regime.
Palestinians have warned against the dangers of Biden's agenda and the attempts to integrate the Israeli regime into the region and expand the circle of normalization with it. Analysts say that all U.S. administrations have adopted the same biased policy towards the Israeli regime.
When it comes to Israel and Israeli security, there is no difference at all between Republicans and Democrats. What we are witnessing today is that Democratic President Joe Biden's support for the deal of the century and his support for further normalization between Israel and the Arab countries.
Palestinians are calling on the free people of the world to reject the arrogance and policies of the United States that target the region's security and stability.
Observers say that Joe Biden's visit will only give the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Wednesday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced his resignation at the end of a bruising day in which his executive survived a confidence vote on a cost of living bill in the Senate, with one of the biggest parties in the government alliance, the Five Star Movement, abstaining from voting. In a statement, Draghi said that the pact of trust at the base of the government's action and the conditions to carry out the executive's program no longer exist. However, President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella rejected Draghi's resignation in an attempt to break the political impasse, inviting the former European Central Bank president to address Parliament and to assess the situation.
I have already said that there won't be a second Draghi government. Let me say, this executive has dealt with the ongoing tensions pretty well.
The Five Star Movement pooled its support for the Draghi government over a bill aimed at helping businesses and households with skyrocketing energy prices and a provision for a trash incinerator in Rome, a project the once anti-establishment party staunchly opposes. The Mario Draghi government was formed after ex-Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's second executive collapsed in February 2021. Draghi was appointed to address the consequences of the pandemic and to manage about 200 billion euros in grants and low-interest loans from the European Union for a radical restructuring of Italy's economy.
As usual, Draghi destroys the small and medium enterprises and destructure the economy rather than restructure it. The perspective is to transform the Italian economy in a weakened economy that will be a sort of ground for big multinational companies.
Italian President Mattarella takes on a central role now. It's up to him to decide whether to try to persuade outgoing Prime Minister Draghi to form another executive, find a new caretaker leader to take the country to an election next year, or call an early elections in September. October would be an unprecedented event in Italy's political history, as in the autumn, the government generally needs to prepare and pass its budget. Max Civili, Rome.
Festival seeks to honor media productions that best introduce Shia Muslims' 8th Imam Reza. Organized by the custodianship of the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza, known as Astan Ghoz Razavi, the media festival acknowledges documentary films, news reports, music clips, and motion graphics, among others, themed with the personality of Imam Reza. Imam Reza was born in 766 AD in the Saudi city of Medina. He's one of the descendants of Islam's prophet, Muhammad. Imam Reza holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran's city of Mashhad, which was known back then as Tus. This love to the Imam draws millions of his lovers to his magnificently decorated shrine every year.
Imam Reza was a scientist, a religious leader, and a politician during the Abbasid dynasty in the 8th century BC, when the ruler of the time invited him to come to Iran to be the crown prince of the Muslim territory. During his tenure, Imam Reza left a lasting influence on Iranians